Election reform advocates want Arizona voters to approve two measures in November. One deals with the election process itself, the other, money.
Partisan affiliation with the dark money component is created partisanship on steroids.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, an update on the federal trial centered on the polygamous towns of Colorado City and Hilldale, why Roosevelt Row property owners got into a heated debate.
Buckeyes working on ways to keep patients from going back to the hospital.
And shining some light on a dark, smoke-filled part of Phoenix history.
The decor of Durant's has been consistently for the 50 years of its existence, kind of like a seedy Atlantic City brothel. And that is part of its seductive charm.
Plus, seeing Arizona through a Canadian lens and bundle up.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay mostly sunny this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high around 69. We should have clear skies tonight with a low of 41. Currently with relative humidity at 14%, it's mostly sunny and 67 degrees. Meanwhile, in valley traffic, one accident. It's on the 51 southbound. It's blocking the shoulder at Cactus.
A coalition hoping to put two election reform measures on this year's ballot is officially starting its effort this afternoon. The Open and Honest Coalition wants Arizona voters to decide on changes to the election process and disclosure of so-called dark money. Chuck Coughlin, president of the consulting firm High Ground, is a co-chair of the coalition, which includes two people against whom he's run campaigns, former Phoenix Mayor Paul Johnson and former Attorney General Terry Goddard. So, Chuck, what exactly would the measures do?
The first initiative is honest disclosure, honest election reform, which would require, it's a constitutional change, which would require the disclosure of contributors who are attempting to influence Arizona candidate elections by spending more than $10,000 on an Arizona candidate race. We will require the original source of that contribution to be disclosed, and we will assert in the Constitution that Arizonans have a right to know who is attempting to influence their elections when they spend more than $10,000 on a candidate election. The second one is open elections, which would essentially emulate the system that we have today in Arizona and how we elect a vast majority of our mayors and our city council members. It would leave it up to them, those individual jurisdictions, including the state, if they wanted to have partisan affiliation noted next to the candidate's name. But essentially, it would treat all voters and all candidates identically.
What is different in this initiative than the one that voters rejected a few years ago, the open primary initiative?
Correct. So when we did our research on this, we found that most voters don't even know what a primary is. A vast majority of them don't. And so we're not focused on a discussion about primaries. We're talking about equal access. And so what we're talking about is treating all voters equally and making that signature gathering requirement the same. So any candidate that wants to run can run, regardless of party affiliation. You know, the American experiment in our economic experiment is open markets work best. And what we found now is that partisan affiliation with the dark money component is created partisanship on steroids. It is a process now where most of our candidates are fearful of these dark money, undisclosed contributions, and we find both Democrats and Republicans running to the extreme parts of their parties rather than where a majority of the electorate is who wants us, our elected officials, to resolve problems. And we think these two fixes will create a level playing field for all candidates, for all voters, and will give Arizona voters the right to know who's influencing their elections by spending more than $10,000 to influence a candidate election.
What is the advantage in your mind of these two initiatives working together, these two groups basically forming one coalition to work on these two similar but different issues?
It's my experience, Mark, when Paul Johnson came to me after their last election cycle, he asked me if I would help him. I said, no, I don't want to help you. I said, if the only idea here is to go repeat the same thing, which was ideologically driven and not focused on what the Arizona voters want. And what we did and asked Paul's group to do, the Open Elections Committee, to give us the authority to do a lot of research so we could find out what the art of possible was in terms of true electoral reform. I've been running campaigns in Arizona now for over 30 years. And so what I went back to Paul and I said, give us the opportunity to do research to find out what the art of the possible is in terms of election reform. We came upon the system that Arizona already has because we are a progressive state with regards to councils and how we elect our councils and mayors. And then the other thing we discovered in the research was how disturbed the Arizona electorate is with the notion that undisclosed campaign contributions were potentially corrupting our election system here in Arizona. And when we took that information back to the open people, we said it's critical. These two issues are tied together. They must be tied together to help us fix our electoral system and require disclosure so that Arizona voters have a right to know who's influencing their election and that every voter and every candidate gets treated the same, regardless of party affiliation.
Chuck Hoffman is president of the political consulting firm High Ground, also co-chair of Open and Honest Coalition. Chuck, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
The civil rights trial against Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah, had its second day in court today. The case has the Department of Justice accusing the Twin Cities of discriminating against residents who are not members of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block has been at the courthouse covering the trial and joins me now. Jude, what were the highlights of the first day?
Well, we heard opening statements from both sides, and the Department of Justice really opened their case, telling the jury, painting this picture of a church that had really gotten out of control and that the town and the police were complicit in helping carry out that agenda. They very quickly brought up Warren Jeffs, who is in prison in Texas for child sexual assault. They talked about him arranging underage marriages, being a fugitive, how town police had coordinated with him when he was a fugitive, how town police had not stopped any underage marriages, how local government were taking direction from the church in meetings and as part of a strategy to keep out non-church members, denying them housing and utilities. When it was the defense lawyer's turn, they explained to the jury, you know, the church is not our client. We are not here to defend the church or Warren Jeffs. This is a case against the cities, and we're going to show you that the cities acted appropriately. Really interesting line from the defense. They were saying, we ask you to think about who is discriminating against who here, because of course the government is trying to argue that this is a case where the towns discriminated against people who were not members of the church. And the defense was saying, look, this is the government going after an unpopular church, which is a dangerous thing. But this isn't even the right venue for it because these are the cities who are on the defense here.
And after opening arguments, the Justice Department called its first witness, Dwayne Barlow. He was also on the stand this morning. Why is he significant to the case?
He's a former FLDS church member who was an assistant for a time to Lyle Jeffs, who is currently the bishop for the church and also a brother to Warren Jeffs. Dwayne Barlow testified about many meetings that he was a part of. When he was part of the church, he was had a pretty high up role, was involved in a lot of high-powered meetings. These were basically backroom meetings that he described between town officials and high-ranking church members, where basically the church would call the shots, say who, for example, they wanted to be on the city council or who should become a police officer. Meetings that he could testify to that showed that intermingling of power. He also talked about the church's security force that had many town officials on that force, that there were public cameras around town used to spy on residents, see if anybody was actually associating with what they call apostates, non-church members, which was not allowed. And they would use these cameras. And that was another example that he was having actual town employees on the church security using cameras to spy on residents.
Jude, finally, court won't be in session tomorrow, but what should we look forward to next week, and how long could this trial last?
The trial is slated to go some 5 weeks, so this is a long haul. I mean, we're still going to be hearing from the Department of Justice. They'll be calling their witnesses for several more days. We're still just at the very beginning here. I know that we will be hearing at some point from an FBI agent who had a role in the arrest of Warren Jeffs, some details about that whole period.
KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reporting on the civil rights trial against Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
A debate over the future of Roosevelt Row became heated inside Phoenix Council chambers last night. KJZZ's senior business correspondent Christina Estes was there and joins me to talk about what happened. So, Christina, the controversy centered on a special designation for the area known as Roosevelt Row. It's downtown Signature Arts District. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, we're talking about the area of 7th Street to 7th Avenue, north and south of Roosevelt Street. The council was asked to allow the creation of a business improvement district. That would allow property owners to form a board that could then assess certain properties every year.
So to be clear, we're talking about property owners paying money to this potential board, right?
Yes, that money would cover improvements in the district to go beyond what the city currently provides. In this case, supporters want the money to go towards things like cleanliness and safety issues, beautification projects, a parking plan, and marketing. Here's what one supporter, Cindy Dash, told council members.
I have planted trees, I have personally cleaned up trash, I have called the police when fights have been broken out in makeshift campgrounds that have been set up on vacant speculative lots. I know what my increased tax will be, and I have determined that will actually be far less than my volunteer hours, my personal expenditure of materials, and my time responding to those in need in our community.
So how much money does this group need, and who's being asked to pay?
City staff created a report that estimated a budget of nearly $400,000. It included assessing 400 parcels, anywhere from a few hundred up to $3,000 a year. Now, these are not single-family homes. They include vacant lots, commercial properties, and condos and apartments that have more than four units. In all, we're talking 211 property owners, including Karen Baer, who said she was there before the artists moved in.
They came because of us, just because we're not part of that clique. Doesn't mean that we have not contributed. The winners of this are the well-connected people with the loudest voice to convince you, and they get the jobs, and they're convincing you to tax me, tax my land for their benefit. That is wrong.
Now, Christina, it's not just the assessment, or as they call it, a tax they don't like. Opponents also raised issues about the process, right?
They said they were told if more than 50% of people opposed it, it would not happen, and they expected a vote. Instead, they say you had to go through this complicated protest process, which some people didn't know about. If you didn't go through the formal protest process, they say their silence was considered a show of support. Another interesting point raised by one opponent had to do with a map detailing the properties involved. He claimed it didn't meet requirements of state law, and he kept pushing after the council voted. Guess what? Turned out staff did not have the square footage of each property listed on the map, so that map was technically incomplete. And that led council members to reverse their vote. It's the first time I've seen anything like that. In the end, they approved the creation of the district, but they put off voting on any map that details the properties until at least next month.
So, Christina, on a slightly different topic, the last time we talked about the Phoenix City Council, it had postponed voting on a drone ordinance. They did that again yesterday. Why?
Well, the people involved think it's written so well that they want to see if they can convince state legislators to get a bill through this session. So Phoenix is putting off the drone ordinance vote until April.
That's KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, marking 100 years since Einstein's theory of relativity, which has its origins in the scientist's teen years.
One of the things he started to think about when he was 16, different than many 16-year-olds nowadays, was what would it be like to be sitting on a light ray? What would the world look like?
Where did Einstein's theories come from? We'll find out later on the show. Good afternoon. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, we have accidents on the 51 southbound at Cactus. Also on the 202 eastbound, that's the Santan Freeway, there's a collision at Alma School Road. We should stay mostly sunny through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature to reach very, very close to 70 degrees. Should be mostly clear for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 40s. And then for tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 71 degrees. currently with relative humidity at 13%. We have some high thin clouds, otherwise mostly sunny, and 69 degrees at KJZZ at 218.
KJZZ is supported by St. Xavier University, now enrolling at their new Gilbert location, offering bachelor degree completion and graduate programs in business education, professional studies, and nursing. More at sxu.edu/Gilbert.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton met with his counterparts from Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other Western cities in Washington, D.C. yesterday for what he called a Water Solutions Summit. This follows the deal Phoenix and Tucson struck to try to ensure the future water supply for both cities. Carolyn Barron, Program Director for Sustainability with the National League of Cities, says municipalities have been taking more of a lead on these kinds of issues.
Sustainable and innovative water policies, particularly in the area of sustainability and to address the effects of climate change.
Barron says that generally started within the past decade, in part out of necessity. She says ideally that happens in concert with the state and federal governments.
There's no choice really but to put conservation policies in place. And, you know, that is coming at both levels of government. But on the other hand, it's probably more at the local level where they're addressing the more immediate impacts of climate change.
So what are the roles for the state and cities in developing and implementing these kinds of policies? To find out, I'm joined by Tom Bouchotsky, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. He's also served as Phoenix's Water Resources Management Advisor. So, Tom, what can and should cities be doing in this area?
So I think the cities have a leadership role in developing water policies, especially ones that relate to conservation. So each individual city has their own unique set of water supplies, their own unique demand patterns. They also have mandatory conservation requirements if they're in the active management areas. And a one-size-fits-all doesn't necessarily work. And so we, the department who regulate that, leave it up to those cities to figure out how to achieve that conservation goal.
So given that you think cities need to have a leadership role, what then is the role of the state as far as saying, okay, this is what we think needs to happen for the entire state versus what cities are saying, look, this is the approach that we want to take here?
So I think at the statewide level, we kind of set the goals for how much conservation should actually be achieved. And then it's up to the city. So we kind of set the bar. They figure out how to meet the bar. In the non-active management area parts of the state, there aren't mandatory conservation requirements. We do have a requirement under law for any water provider that has 15 connections or more to actually have a water conservation plan. But there's no enforceable, you have to reach X goal as part of that water conservation plan. And with those communities, we will work with them to help them put those plans together. They have more limited resources than the bigger cities in the active management areas. We do have different sets of best management practices and things that we know work that can be used as resources for both the cities inside and outside the active management areas. So it's very much of a partnership. There's certainly a regulatory component, but it's a partnership as well.
What do you make of the fact that cities are starting now also to work together on plans? Phoenix and Tucson have their arrangement this week. The mayors of Phoenix and LA and San Francisco and some other cities are in Washington trying to figure out what role cities can play in this. Do you think of this as a positive development?
I absolutely think of this as a positive development. I think the cities who are ultimately responsible for providing wet water to their citizens and to their businesses need to create as much flexibility and resiliency as they can. And those types of partnerships can add to that resiliency and flexibility and also help reduce their costs. I mean, you're taking advantage of existing infrastructure that each party has, so you don't have to build your own.
Do you consider this an example of the level of government that is closest to the people sort of having to deal with sort of these day-to-day type issues? As you say, the cities are responsible for making sure that there's water coming out of the tap when somebody turns on the faucet. Is that one of the reasons you think that cities are becoming so involved in this area?
I do think that it's one of the reasons they're becoming involved, but many cities in Arizona have been involved for many decades on their own. What's important to me from a state perspective is when the state of Arizona, for example, is dealing with Colorado River issues with the federal government and the six other basin states, we view the cities who have Colorado River water in their portfolios as partners with us. And it is important in the discussions as we grapple with those issues, the issues of drought, the issues of protecting the falling Lake Mead elevations, that Arizona has one voice in dealing with our partners in the other states in the federal government, that we're on the same page and all kind of pulling in the same direction. I think that would set up the best possible outcome for the state.
Tom Bouchotsky is director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Tom, thank you.
Thanks.
The events marking the centennial of Albert Einstein's theory of relativity have been held around the world, and tomorrow in Tempe, ASU's Origins Project is hosting a panel called Einstein's Legacy, celebrating 100 years of general relativity. Professor Lawrence Krauss leads the Origins Project and will be the event's moderator. Andy joins me now. Professor Krauss, other than his physical appearance, most people think of E equals MC squared when they think of Einstein, but that's not what his general theory of relativity is. That's different, right?
That's different. E equals MC squared was sort of the first thing he did that made him known among scientists. Most people don't realize that E equals MC squared, which is 1905, his miracle year, when as a literally unemployed physicist, he was a patent clerk, he published four papers, each of which changed physics, each of which could have won the Nobel Prize. And in fact, by the way, interesting, he never won the Nobel Prize for relativity. But E equals MC squared was 1905. That began to make him well-known and got him a job as a physicist and as ultimately as a professor. But he was not known around the world till, in fact, about 1919, when his general theory of relativity had already been completed and one of the greatest pieces of work any scientist has done since Newton. But even then, it wasn't until, and it's kind of poetic, it was a British expedition, after World War I, a British expedition went and down to South America to look at an eclipse, because he had predicted that the theory of relativity predicts that space is curved in the presence of matter. And that meant that light travels in curved trajectories. So light from stars behind the sun could curve around the sun, and you could see stars behind the sun. But of course, you can't see them when the sun is shining. So they waited for an eclipse, and then they saw stars that they knew were behind the sun. And it was tested by Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington. But I think the poetry was that a British expedition tested the ideas of a German scientist right after World War I. And that announcement that his prediction was correct was on the front pages of papers around the world. And he became an instant celebrity. That's what made Einstein Einstein.
Have you ever had a hypothetical conversation in your head with Einstein almost saying, think about the impact that you've had. And do you ever think about saying how you'd want to tell him about the impact the general theory of relativity's had on what's come after it?
Well, you know, it would be nice to ask him what result most satisfied and surprised me. You should know that general relativity is almost unique in the sense that he was working in more or less isolation on a very theoretical idea. And people seem to think there was no empirical basis. There is an empirical basis. But still, there was very little contact because general relativity is manifest only on scales where the gravity is incredibly strong, and we don't experience that here on Earth. Most people may think gravity is strong when they try and wake up and get to work in the morning, but it's very weak. It's the weakest force in nature. When he first wrote his theory down, one thing he did do a calculation of, which is a weird and obscure effect. It's kind of amazing he knew about it. Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun, orbits the sun. But its orbit precesses. That means orbits are elliptical, and that means they sort of have bumps at either end. They're not perfectly circular. And the position of those bumps moves around in a circle over time, so it precesses. Well, that wasn't understood. Newton's theory of gravity didn't give such a thing. And there are lots of effects that could have produced it, perhaps. But when Einstein developed general relativity, he thought, well, I'm changing the nature of gravity slightly. Let me calculate. And it produced exactly the precession of Mercury. And at that time, he said, basically, he had heart palpitations. He almost fainted because then he really knew he was describing nature.
Legend has it, of course, that Newton was sitting under an apple tree and got hit on the head. Did Einstein have any legendary moments that were supposed to tie to the theory of relativity?
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, he's talked a lot of relativity he did by what's called Gedanken experiments, because And at Gedanken, that's a thought experiment in German. Because, of course, there weren't experiments. You couldn't travel near the speed of light. You couldn't. So and one of the things he started to think about when he was 16, different than many 16-year-olds nowadays, was what would it be like to be sitting on a light ray? What would the world look like? And that led him to the special theory of relativity. And what led him, the thought experiment in some sense that led him to general relativity was what happens in an elevator in space. You know, when everyone's had the experience of being in an elevator, and when it starts to go up, you suddenly feel heavier, right? And so if you're in an elevator in empty space and it starts to accelerate all upward and there are no windows, you're pushed down to the floor. But how do you know that's not gravity? And so that was the thought experiment that got him going on this. And it's beautiful that because I think everyone can appreciate those kind of things. So for him, it was that. He said when he was a kid, I think being, you know, when he got magnets, I think a lot of people, you know, that fascinated him with science. But so it wasn't, there wasn't the apple tree moment, but there were the thought experiment moments.
Arizona State University professor Lawrence Krauss, he's the head of the Origins Project at ASU. We've been talking about the event taking place Friday night at Gamage. It's called Einstein's Legacy, celebrating 100 years of general relativity. Professor Krauss, thanks.
Thanks. It's been great.
A pilot project in Buckeye aimed at lowering hospital readmission rate seems to be working. The local readmission rate is 17%. The rate for patients in the pilot program is a quarter of that. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports, the goal is to keep patients out of the hospital by bringing paramedics into their homes.
Hi, this is Mackenzie from CP 701 in Buckeye.
It's the last hours of Buckeye Fire Captain Mackenzie Hess's 48-hour shift. And he, along with paramedic Jim Helms, are spending the time making house calls around town.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm damn what I was.
It's good to see you. Good to see you again.
Their first stop is Betty and Lou Rogers' house, a couple who are both in their 70s. Betty has a pacemaker and complains about nausea. Helms puts monitors on Betty's arms and legs. A sheet prints out the heart monitor data, and things are looking good for Betty today.
Well, looks like you're ticking along pretty good now.
Look at you go.
Yeah.
They move on to Lou and talk to the two not just about their health, but about the weather, Lou's new truck, and the salt Betty needs for salami she makes for the firemen.
You can talk to them, and it's not like talking to a doctor or a nurse. It's just like talking to a friend.
The house visit is part of a pilot paramedicine program Buckeye introduced as a way to lower hospital readmissions. Helms and Hess's job is to go to patients who have been to Banner Health Estrella Medical Center and help them with things like making sure they're taking prescribed medication correctly, a big reason patients return to hospitals. Some research shows around 20% of cases never even fill prescribed medication. Buckeye Fire Department teamed up with its medical director, Dr. Todd Cleaver, to develop the program.
Community paramedicine is a new thing. It's only been in the last couple of years that people have developed these programs. Nobody really knows exactly how to do it yet, so we're kind of making it up as we go along.
And it's working. Out of 131 paramedicine patients, only 4 were readmitted within 30 days. Buckeye is extending the program for another 6 months and is looking for ways to keep it around permanently.
Hospitals are penalized by the federal government if they readmit too many patients. So the goal is to reduce that percentage.
Hospitals can be fined up to 3% of Medicare funding if a patient is readmitted within 30 days. While the program is working to save money, the patients seem to get more out of the visits than just a quick checkup.
After the first time, I thought, no, they don't need to come back. And then by the time it was time, I did have a bad couple of days. And, you know, talking to somebody that's seen it, done it, been around it, it's different.
That's 72-year-old Marvin Lloyd, the third patient of the day. He had a spine fusion surgery a few months ago and is going through physical therapy. For Lloyd, the home visits help him mentally as much as physically. His wife, Diane, thinks so too.
He's always got a lift after the guys have been here and a little more positive outlook and everything.
Paramedic Helms gives Lloyd words of encouragement at his visit. He says while he hasn't been doing this kind of work long, he thinks the program does more than just keep people out of hospitals.
I take as much from it as I think the patients do. I learn a little bit of something that I didn't know before or key in on something, and I think it ultimately probably make me a better paramedic.
For now, the program is still in pilot mode, but Cleaver says the goal is to expand it out and continue to bridge the gap between hospital and patient. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, reporting from Buckeye.
You are listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Cesar, and right now I'm making a snowman. Well, it's going pretty good for being the first time.
I think this can be the nose.
The nose?
The last time I saw the snow was 3 years ago. Just amazing. You look everywhere, it's white, and then it's not like down in Phoenix. It's everywhere you turn around, it's desert.
Strongest.
We come up here because we're looking for something fun, and then this is more than I was expecting. It's gorgeous.
That's Cesar Ruiz playing in the snow with his family at Flagstaff Nordic Center. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to hit us with a good big snowball, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, a renowned choreographer comes to ASU, but to do more than dance.
So when people think about dance, I think sometimes they're thinking just about the steps. But in my case, the dancing and the movement is sort of an underplay that might also include talking and definitely video.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Checking Valley traffic at this hour. No accidents to tell you about. We are seeing a little bit of heavy slowing, though, on I-17 northbound, just past Indian School Road. We're seeing some high, thin clouds outside. We're expecting, though, mostly sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon and a high temperature around 70 degrees. And then for tonight, we should be clear with lows in the lower 40s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, a little bit warmer than today, with a high in the lower 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 13%, and it's 69 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2016 Subaru Legacy, the 36 mpg midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Google has an indoor slide. Facebook has a video game room. These are the kinds of things we've come to expect in creative office spaces. But experts at the Urban Land Institute Arizona's Trends Day conference yesterday said this might not be what most companies want. Mike Davis is the founder of the urban planning firm Davis.
Some of your bigger corporations are going back and actually putting in private offices. Noise-canceling devices and headphone sales are going through the roof. A lot of it's a work environment thing, and there's a lot of people not working at work because you can't work. You go home and work, you know, or go somewhere else and work.
Another session at the conference focused on the people you might expect to see in a creative office, millennials. Jenny Poon founded the co-working space Cahoots in Phoenix, which employs a lot of millennials, and she says they really value flexibility.
Go ahead and take a day off as long as your work is completed, or you've figured out how to structure your work so that it's going to be done and I don't need to worry about it. But it doesn't matter if you're doing this at midnight, I'm fine with that. And that's a hard thing for a lot of employers to understand.
The moderator said millennials also value purpose at work and instant gratification, something employers will have to account for as more of this generation enters the workplace, whether or not that workplace includes a playground. Arizona has taken a new approach to talking about HIV prevention. The state's new ads feature people doing everyday type activities and then running into unforeseen dangers. The tagline, "It's only dangerous if you don't know it's there." Joining me to talk about this campaign and its effects so far is John Sapero, the Office Chief for HIV Prevention Program at the Arizona Department of Health Services. John, tell me about the thinking behind this new approach, because it seems like a pretty significant departure from what health officials had been doing.
Sure, it's very much so. Traditionally, messaging around HIV has been more fear-based and perhaps a little bit downbeat. And my group got together, and what they said was fear-based messaging isn't working anymore. It's been too consistent for the past 30 years. That's what everybody's heard. They wanted an upbeat message that said, now more than ever, it's a great time to be tested for HIV. And if you do find out that you're positive, to get entered into care. And that they wanted it to be creative and engaging.
Do you think that this kind of message would have been possible 5 or 10 years ago?
I'm not sure that it would have had the success that it has now. You know, as we look at the evolution of HIV media, I don't think people were ready to hear an upbeat message around HIV and getting linked to care.
Do you think that any part of that fear-based messaging was actually helping keep people safe and protect them, that maybe they were making decisions based on that fear and being afraid of HIV, and that by sort of taking that away, that their decisions might be different as a result?
One of the goals of this campaign that came out very clearly from my advisory group was that people really understand the mechanics of how HIV is transmitted and what they need to do to protect themselves. However, for whatever reason, there is a time when that judgment call or that decision-making process might not occur. So what they wanted to do was really say, think about this. The only time that HIV is dangerous is when you don't know it's there. And that really developed the tagline of the campaign. And so if we encourage people to get tested and we encourage people who are living with HIV to get into care, we'll have tremendous benefits in terms of prevention.
How much of the message is also just to get people to talk about it, people with and without HIV?
Exactly. That was another component of what they wanted to accomplish. You know, in Arizona, I don't think we've had a lot of conversation around HIV until the campaign came about.
Is this new campaign targeted at maybe a different demographic than earlier campaigns were?
We certainly look at target population. So people, areas of Arizona where people live that are contracting HIV. The CDC wants us to be good stewards of our funds, right? So they don't want to just do this broad messaging that hopefully touches everybody that it can. They really want to be targeted. So we looked at zip codes where high numbers of people were contracting HIV, and then the transit lines that were going through there, digital media that they might access, what have you, and we use that to really target two populations. I think one thing that's really interesting in terms of the visitors to the website we direct people to, HIVAZ.org, is that over 20% of them are women, and that's not usually an audience that is listening to an HIV message.
You have been running this ad for a couple of months now. Mm-hmm. What kind of results have you seen?
It's really amazing. So the site that we direct people to for testing information and linkage to care information, without any media presence at all, was typically receiving about 60 to 90 hits a day. So all word of mouth. Within 3 days of the campaign launch, that had grown to 800 hits a day, and consistently, it got as high as 1,200 hits a day and has consistently remained within that 800 to 1,200 as the campaign has progressed. For me, I think the interesting aspect of that is traditionally, before the campaign started, about 85% of the site visitors were new. That ratio has changed now to 60% new and 40% returning. So clearly, we've hit a great audience that wants the information and is coming back to it again and again.
John Sapero is Office Chief for the HIV Prevention Program with the Arizona Department of Health Services. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. The show is a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, and national and international news to provide a stream of engaging radio. Sunny skies over Phoenix, 69 degrees at KJZZ at 2:45.
Striking photographs of Arizona's natural wonders are nothing new, but when they're taken by someone who's not as familiar with the area and who lives in a place with an entirely different climate and topography, the impact can be special. That's what Canadian-based photographer Brian Shane discovered. He has a new book of images called Arizona Rising, and he joins me now. Brian, do you think people who live in places with diversity that includes desert, mountains, and water can sometimes take it for granted?
Yeah, I think so. Especially when, you know, there's a lot of desert and stuff around that, and yeah, it's not apparent. You have to go searching for it a little bit. And a lot of the places we visited, you know, are the national parks, of course, Zion and the Grand Canyon. But, you know, a lot of the places were out of the way on Navajo lands, like Monument Valley and Antelope Canyon. And these places are just spectacular. You have to look a bit for them. Arizona reminds me a little bit of Newfoundland in the sense that Newfoundland is a big island off the east coast of Canada, and it's full of pine and scrub bush, but, you know, the beautiful parts are on the coast. And in Arizona, I mean, a lot of it's desert, but, you know, there's a lot of beautiful parts, you know, hidden that you have to look for a little bit. But I never saw such a concentration of beautiful spots. And, you know, you can tell that when you have that sense of peace, sense of sort of an elevated consciousness that you get in a place. It's almost like a feeling of grace just being there. And, you know, we had that consistently in Arizona.
What drew you to Arizona and the Southwest in the first place? Had you seen images? Had you had friends who had traveled here and made it sound like this? Or were you in some ways really stunned by how beautiful it was?
We bought a motorhome, and we had planned to travel in the American Southwest. So we had done one trip to Utah, and the second leg of our trip was to Arizona, and the third leg is California. So we had made a conscious effort to do that. You know, I still think it has the greatest concentration of world-class landscape that I've ever seen anywhere in the world. I mean, you can drive to it in 3 hours. I mean, from to Flagstaff from Phoenix is a three-hour drive, and, you know, you're right there.
What did friends or acquaintances in Canada think when they saw some of the photos that you saw, maybe even folks who've actually been to Arizona before?
You know, they all said the same thing. I mean, the state is, I mean, you know, you can be an icon, and you know, like the Grand Canyon is an icon, but there's nothing other to describe it than grand. They call it the Grand Canyon because it is grand, and all the superlatives that you use to describe it can't begin to capture it. We were lucky we went to the north rim of the Grand Canyon in November, just before it was closing, and they were doing a controlled burn at the time that simulated the effect of fog. And so the cover image on Arizona Rising is a shot going towards San Francisco of the north rim of the Grand Canyon from Bright Angel Point, and it's stunning. I mean, just everybody that's seen that image went, oh my God, that's incredible. And so, you know, like, you know, you don't do photography to make money. You do it because it's a passion, and you know, you want to share your joy of what you see with other people. And everybody that's seen Monument Valley or north rim of the Grand Canyon said the same thing. Wow. I don't know. I mean, I was brought up, you know, on Westerns and, you know, and all that stuff. And so it, you know, it has a deep-seated meaning for me.
Brian Shane, photographer based in Ottawa, Canada. And the name of his book is called Arizona Rising. Brian, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Valley weather for the rest of today will stay mostly sunny, looking for a high temperature around 70 degrees. And then for tonight, should be mostly clear with lows around 40. And then for tomorrow, mostly sunny skies and a high in the lower 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 13%, partly cloudy, 69 degrees. You're listening to the show on KJZZ at 249.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting an evening of music and humor with Tony Award-winning Jason Alexander, known for his role as George Costanza on Seinfeld, January 30th and 31st, phoenixsymphony.org.
ASU is starting a new lab, which will bring together researchers, artists, and civic leaders, among other people, to try to make an impact in the community. The Ensemble Lab in the Herberger Institute of Design and the Arts will be led by choreographer and MacArthur Fellow Liz Lerman. She founded the Dance Exchange in 1976 and has since done projects ranging from telling the stories of military veterans returning home to looking into the relationship between art and science.
All these art schools are trying to figure out both how to do more multidisciplinary work across themselves, but then also how to reach across the campuses, and then finally how to reach into the communities. And I think Stephen brought me predominantly because my own history mirrors those activities. That is, spending time, what I would describe as equal commitment to concert and community, spending time in different disciplines, which is just a thrill.
So how do you try to incorporate different sciences and humanities and other subjects that students and teachers discuss at a university with arts and dance?
Yeah, so when people think about dance, I think sometimes they're thinking just about the steps. But in my case, the dancing and the movement is sort of an underplay that might also include talking and definitely video. There's these days many different ways to get the story across, but the dancing is critical. It's like thinking about how movement is just, movement underlies everything to me, but it isn't the only way to tell the story. So in my case, I started working with scientists over a decade ago, working on a piece about genetics, and it turned out, of course, the body is a great place to go explore some of the big questions that they're grappling with, but in a really personal and intimate way.
Do you find that some of the students and other folks in the non-arts disciplines are skeptical of trying to explain a scientific principle through dance, for example?
Well, you know, I would have said 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, a lot of skepticism, but that is changing. And part of why that's changing is because creativity itself is on the table as something that people know we need to have, that if we're going to problem solve in this world, that the problems are too big to solve in just one way. So any mechanism that you have to bring people together to try to sort that out, and it turns out art is really good at that. So there's less skepticism. Of course, you know, I'm talking to the people that are opening their doors. I don't know what's going on behind those closed doors. And the other thing is, you know, I don't really mind resistance. I think when people say, "What are you talking about?" it actually gives you a chance to try again to make sense out of what the thing is that you're doing.
So are there particular issues you're trying to take on or questions you're trying to answer with your work here?
Well, I'm a very curious person, so almost anything is interesting to me. But in this particular class I'm teaching, we'll be working with somebody from the United Way who's working with the homeless. And they're trying to get some information out to the public in Phoenix about what it actually costs. And I think we're going to be able to make a real case through this class for people to think and feel this. One thing I think is, you know, in our world, you get your information, say, from the news, and you get your feeling, I don't know, from the movies or from fiction. I'm advocating, let's put them together. Let's put the information and the feelings in the same place so that you actually can motivate yourself to create change.
Is it, in some ways, do you think, easier to discuss some of the issues that you try to discuss when it's not just somebody standing on a stage explaining it, but you have dancers and you have video and you have other people sort of explaining it in different and creative ways?
Well, I like to think so, because I think actually most of us human beings, we have this incredible capacity to receive information and data in so many different ways. And sometimes, for example, you hear a speech, you are actually in your own imagination, you're personalizing the information, but you don't have time to sort of take that in because you're But if there's a dance that's happening in the middle of that, you have a chance to reflect. The movement helps you think about it. Yeah, I think you can hear it and see it differently.
How will you judge ultimately whether what you're doing here is successful?
Well, the really big idea behind Stephen Tepper's invitation to me and behind both what ASU is trying to do and what the Herberger is trying to do is to not so much redefine, because I think the role of artists in society, if you take it over hundreds of years, has been really engaging. It's not like we haven't had periods in our existence where art is really important. I think the role of artists being asked to reflect and not be so narrow and so maybe worried just about our own pursuits, but to actually expand and make the value of the things that we know, because in order to make dance, in order to do this, be creative and make the work, there's so many things that we do that other disciplines, other fields, other people could get their hands on.
Liz Lerman is a choreographer, a MacArthur Fellow, and author. She'll be launching the Ensemble Lab at ASU. Liz, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Mark.
Durant's, the bright pink old-school steakhouse in Midtown Phoenix, has a reputation for good food, old-fashioned service, and for being a place connected with the mysterious, including the mafia underworld. A new locally made movie called Durant's Never Closes opens tonight, and KJZZ's Sarah Ventry explains just what makes the restaurant and its famed owner so singular.
Your experience of Durant's starts when you find the entrance. Walk in off the street and everyone knows you're an outsider. If you know what you're doing, you walk in the back door, first through the kitchen and then into the dining room. Immediately, it's as though you've stepped into another time. Textured red walls, high-backed half-circle leather booths, crudité served before your meal, and the room draped in red.
The lighting is poor, the tables are crowded, it's noisy, the sleek waiters running around, you have interesting people over there, you wonder who those people might be, what sort of conversations they're having.
That's David Foster. He's the author of the book Glimpses of Phoenix and taught a class at ASU called Phoenix and Cultural Production. He's also been a patron at Durant's for about 5 decades.
The decor of Durant's has been consistently for the 50 years of its existence, kind of like a seedy Atlantic City brothel. And that is part of its seductive charm.
The other part of its seductive charm is the legend of its namesake, Jack Durant.
Jack Durant died in 1987, right? We're still talking about him. There's a reason behind that. He was larger than life.
Travis Mills is the director of the new movie Durant's Never Closes, starring Tom Sizemore as Jack Durant. And in a tale full of muddled facts and half-century-old rumors, one thing is certain. The more you ask about Durant, the more confusing the story becomes.
During his lifetime, no one really knew where he was from. Some people would say Florida, Kentucky, Chicago. No one knew.
But the most pervasive rumor about Durant is his connection to the mob. Here's a clip from the movie trailer.
Who are you guys talking about?
Jack Durant.
That's the guy that owns this place, right?
Right.
I heard he was in the mob.
One of the abiding myths is that Durant came down here to found the restaurant as a front for the mob operations in Phoenix, represented by Bugsy Siegel.
Foster is quick to say that to the best of his knowledge, no one has been able to verify this. But in a lot of ways, it's just as important that many people still wonder about it.
This whole phenomenon of Jack Durant is the urban myth that gives the restaurant its whole reason for being.
Even if he wasn't in the mob himself, stories swirl about the mob using Durant's as a meeting place or that he associated with mobsters. Director Travis Mills says that he's heard lots of different stories about Durant, some that make him sound like a great guy and some that make him sound like a terrible person. His personal favorite?
Durant was so angry at a customer one time that he ran into the back and grabbed a meat cleaver, and it took the entire staff to stop him from running out onto the floor and using it on the customer.
The simple idea that Jack Durant owned the restaurant isn't even confirmed. Some say he ran the restaurant but didn't own it, or that he was just a part owner. For director Travis Mills,
it's a place full of so much history. A lot happened here. Politicians ate there, celebrities. A lot of important things, good and bad, I think happened in those walls. For a storyteller, it's the perfect location.
And the stories will keep being told.
A major urban area needs a certain amount of dirty history to sustain itself. Things can't always be the Chamber of Commerce.
Foster says people want to believe in the hope and pride of their city.
But at the same time, they're interested in having a connection with a place that has some juicy bits of nasty history.
And for us, that nasty history comes with a juicy steak. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Durant's Never Closes premieres tonight at the Renaissance Phoenix Downtown Hotel and starts a week-long run tomorrow at Harkins Shea 14.
And make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. We'll get you ready for some football, specifically Sunday's NFC Championship game between the Cardinals and the Carolina Panthers. Plus, a look back at the effort to preserve Scottsdale's open desert. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shadow and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John, the puzzling one, Hoban.
I can't follow that. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Ring by Name, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses working to help you build better relationships with your customers and designed to make your business run better. You can learn more at ringbyname.com.